Today's Taisho will be on case 9 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 9 is entitled Joshu's Four Gates. Can everybody hear me? Yes, okay. Engo's introduction. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. With the Bakuyu sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one arrives. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one arrives. Life is found in death, death in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Sutra's verse. Its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, east, south, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. So, this is the second day of our experimental online sesshin. And I want to thank everybody for doing a really excellent job. You know, we are exploring this medium, and I think we've been pretty successful, actually. Last night's issue with Doka-san, I just didn't know. I didn't know that you couldn't host one meeting, leave the meeting, and host another meeting. Apparently, that's not good manners in Zoom land. And so when I went to host another meeting, it closed the meeting everybody was in. So tonight we'll have a different Zoom meeting. And, you know, it's a little frustrating, but we pretty much got I got to do Doka-san with everybody who came except for one person, and she'll be first tonight. You know, when we have problems like that, it not only is it to be expected, but it's really wonderful opportunity, you know, wonderful opportunity to deepen our practice. You know, first of all of the United States, I don't have to say it, but all over the United States, people's lives have been totally disrupted by what's happened. You know, school systems have shut down, and at Rutgers, where I teach, you know, in the middle of the year, they closed down the university. And the whole faculty, thousands of people, had to learn to teach online, basically over spring vacation. And, you know, as you can imagine, it was an uneven performance with a lot of mistakes. I myself had a couple occasions where I had planned this class out, and then I had some internet snafu that kept me from basically going online. And it was so frustrating. You know, so the whole country is in this situation where we're reinventing things on the fly, and nobody likes it. I mean, I myself am very careful about what happens in my classes, and I plan them out, you know, pretty meticulously. And, you know, suddenly I couldn't go into the classroom, and it's so hard to teach when you can't look at people and read their faces and get a sense of the feedback. So, you know, basically when you're talking to people, if they look sleepy, you don't even think about it. You know, you change the subject. You begin to move in a different direction because they don't seem engaged. And then if they begin to be bright-faced, you think, oh, now this is where I could go. And you don't necessarily make these calculations consciously. But, you know, you do make these calculations. And as a result, you know, the class, if you're adept at this, sort of reading your students, you know, the class can go pretty well. You know, if you tell a joke and it doesn't get any response from the students in your, 10-10 class, you don't tell the same joke in your 1-10 class. You tried another joke, right? So, you know, all of this is gone. And it's like we're starting, I feel like I'm starting in the first grade in a way. You know, I don't know all of these platforms, all of these resources. Last night we have a structure to Sesshin, and we've been following that structure, I think, pretty effectively online. Last night the whole thing broke down. And when things break down like that, it's a very interesting experience, you know. When things break down like that, you know, a few days ago, I was talking about habit energies. And, you know, our habit energies are what make things real for us, right? So, you know, I mentioned that when we get up in the morning, almost everybody in America gets up at the same time, you know. Unless you're retiree or you're preschooler, right? You know, you get up around 7 o'clock, and it may be give or take, right? So some people get up at 5 o'clock because they have to do something very early in the morning, and some people get up at 8. You know, that's unusual, I think. And in between are all the people who get up at the normal hour, and they all get up and they take a shower or have breakfast and take a shower. Or take a shower and have breakfast. And some people shower in the evening, and some people don't eat breakfast. But on the whole, you know, it's breakfast, shower, shower, breakfast. You get on your work clothes, you know, you get on your clothes for your job. You get in your car, and you drive to your place of work. And then, you know, between 5 and 7, pretty much the whole of New Jersey goes home from work, right? The whole adult population of New Jersey goes home to work. And this is reality. This is what we call reality. And you could say, well, what makes it real? And if you said that to a certain kind of person, they would become frustrated and angry at you. They'd say, well, what do you mean? You know, since I'm an English professor, somebody might say, oh, you English professors, you know, you live in an ivory tower, you live in a kingdom in the sky, you don't know what reality is, Buster. You know, but reality is getting up every day and having to get to work at, you know, and put in your 8 hours. But actually, you know, that's not reality. That's not reality. That's habit energy, right? It's habit energy. And we work very hard to maintain our habits, whether they're beneficial or destructive, right? So we work very hard to maintain our habits. I mentioned this a few days ago, you know, I used for almost 20 years, I had a Monday, Thursday, I had a Tuesday, Wednesday and a Wednesday, Friday classes. Those are my classes. Monday, Wednesday, Wednesday, Friday. So every Friday I was in my classroom. In the Friday mornings I was in my classroom for like 15 years or so. And then for various reasons I changed to like a Tuesday, Thursday schedule. And I remember going out on a Friday to shop. And I was in the grocery store and I suddenly had this wave of guilt, or like, this is so wrong. You know, I should not be shopping on a work day, right? I should be at my job. You know, I'm an employee of the state of New Jersey. And that was such a crazy idea, right? That is like such a crazy idea. And yet, you know, it was real because I was getting out of my habit energy loops, right? I was getting out of my habit energy loops. I mean, our society spends a lot of time making sure we never leave those loops, right? So you know, basically, when you're at a certain age, if you're, especially if you're, well, even doesn't matter what gender, I guess, anymore. When you're around 13, you know, one of the most exciting things in the world that you can do is to cut school, right? And if your parents don't see you get on the school bus, you know, one of the most terrifying and exciting things you can do is actually to walk to the school bus and then take a powder, especially if you have a friend who's equally disobedient, right? And the two of you can hang out all day, and it's both exhilarating and it's terrifying, right? Because you're breaking with the habit energy. And it's terrifying because you fear repercussions. And also, there's something, you know, this word, I love this word, vertiginous. It's like dizzying about having no structures. And so, you know, you're playing on the edge of this abyss, really. You're 13 years old. You're defying authority. You're not going to school. And of course, you know, basically, the principal or the monitor at school will call your parents and say, why didn't Kurt come to class? And then he'll call, say, Mrs. Bryant up and say, Sonny didn't come to class. And then Mrs. Bryant will call Mrs. Spellmeyer and say, was Kurt in class today? Sonny didn't go to class. And then we'll get into trouble, right? In a sense, nobody wants to get in trouble, but in another sense, it's actually very reassuring to get into trouble. If you're a teenager, getting into trouble is like reassuring, because what you did was so crazy. You didn't go to school, you know, and school is divided into periods. You know, this period is this. I didn't hell with periods. You know, I just went out and played with Sonny Bryant all day, right? So, you know, it was reassuring to be yelled at by my mother in a way and to be told, you must never do this again. You've been a really bad boy and you need to maintain the regime, the regimen, right? You need to maintain our reality structure, whatever you do. And, you know, I never did it again. I had stepped out. I didn't necessarily like it. My day of freedom was not that wonderful, right? After a while, I began to feel I was overwhelmed by guilt. And I also felt this unnerving formlessness. In fact, sometimes I even have dreams where I'm supposed to be in school and I'm not in school. A variation of this is, I have dreams where I realize I never graduated from high school. And I realize I didn't do what I was supposed to do to get out of high school. And I wake up like in terror, right? Oh my God, you know, I didn't finish high school. You know, then I realize, well, who cares? You know, I mean, I'm 60 some years old, you know. But that's the dream of fear that's associated with stepping outside of our energy habits, right? And, you know, even Zen can create these attachments to energy habits. So, you know, we have a very highly structured session day, and it's a good thing, too. And last night it broke down, and when that happens, you realize that what people call reality is not real. It's not real. And that is perhaps the most terrifying insight that anyone can have. And yet, you know, all liberation depends upon that insight. So don't get me wrong. Please don't miss any sits. Please come to the next. We have a sit at 2:30. Please be there. Be on the cushion. Please stay for both sits. Please don't leave in the middle of a sit. You know, so please observe the rules. Nevertheless, you know, all liberation comes from stepping out of our habit energies. And that is a frightening thing. You know, koan training is very interesting because it actually is asking you to step out of your mental habits. It's inviting you to step out of your mental habits. And the reason koan training is so difficult is that it's so frightening and unnerving to be out of your, when you start stepping out of your mental habits, it's frightening and it's unnerving. Basically, Zen practice is really about stepping out of that comfort zone, stepping out of your magic circles of habit energy, and beginning to experience the world in a different way. I remember reading something in Robert Thurman's book. I can't remember the title right now, but he was talking about when he was a student of a Rinpoche in South Jersey. Actually, down in Howell, New Jersey, there's a Mongolian, Kalmyk, Tibetan community down there, and he was actually the student of one of the Rinpoches there, one of the teachers there. And he had come down from Columbia. He was already a graduate student at Columbia. And he was studying with this particular Rinpoche because he had been told this guy is really quite remarkably well-informed about a certain kind of teaching. And so he went down and he said they were reading this sutra together. And as they were reading the sutra together, he began to feel this sense of like everything dropping away. That he actually said that it was like this vertiginous, it's like the ground opens up under you, right? The ground opens up under you. And nobody likes to have the ground open up under you. And Thurman said it was very unnerving, right? As he was reading this, he actually got physically dizzy. One way to think about Zen is that it's preparing you for that experience. It's giving you the tools you need to deal with that, because actually, that's reality. You know, the world humans live in is entirely a constructed world. Everything is constructed. Everything is like imaginary. The world we live in is imaginary. And this is not me saying this. All of the sutras say the same thing. If you read the Diamond Sutra ends by saying, it's like a dream. It's like a bubble. You know, it's like clouds in the air, right? And what they mean is that there is a real world, but all of the things we do in that world, all of the things that have value and meaning for us, we have created the value and meaning. We have created the structures. And, you know, actually most of our suffering comes from not being able to tolerate the dissolution of those structures. Around day two or three of Sesshin, those structures really begin to dissolve. You know, last night we had sort of an early taste of that, you know, as like this very familiar structure of going to Dokusan broke down. And literally, the Zendo disappeared, right? Our virtual Zendo disappeared under our feet, and we're sort of disembodied faces or disembodied voices somewhere. And even though you could say, oh, come on, you're making a big deal out of that, your conscious mind knows it's not important, but your unconscious mind knows it's terrifying. A lot of Zen practice is getting you ready for that experience of the ground opening up beneath your feet. And you need structures to be able to deal with that, to be able to live with that. But with your structures, those same structures can become, you could say, a prison if you don't know how to work with their dissolution. If you don't know how to work with the vertiginous disappearance of things, okay? And, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we do emptiness meditation, mushin, we're going very directly into this state of emptiness where everything disappears to a greater or lesser degree. And it's sort of specialized, it's sort of confined to the cushion. So, last night when the Zendo disappeared under our feet, so to speak, that's terrifying. When you sit down on the cushion, you're letting everything disappear in sort of a controlled way. It's like a controlled vertiginousness, a controlled dissolution of everything. So there's emptiness on the cushion, and then there's the world of form off the cushion. So yesterday we spent about 8 hours on the cushion, and we entered deep emptiness. And then, we got out and we had breakfast or we had lunch, or we talked to people in the house where we're living or the apartment where we're living. And there's a kind of like a gap, right? It's a little bit safe, right? There's emptiness on the cushion, and then you get off the cushion and it's not empty. It's all real. It's all concrete. And you're back in your habits, right? Some people even said, when they're not doing meditation, they are very powerfully drawn back to go online and surf the net or send emails or something. And I said, please don't do that. So these habit energies are very powerful. And a lot of Zen practice is working on taking the emptiness off the cushion and taking it out into the world of form, right? So, basically, as you grow more tolerant of emptiness, as you grow more awake, you could say, you begin to be more tolerant of the experiences of things dissolving around you in your everyday life, as they do all the time. For example, my own situation this year, if you think about it, it's pretty terrifying to have a whole state closed down, actually. I'm pretty insulated from it. All the school systems closing down, the university closing down. For a while, we didn't know who was going to be alive and who was going to be dead. And in fact, a person in my department died. The English department at Rutgers died, a COVID-related death. And a guy, a psychotherapist, a friend of mine, died right down the street. So, for a while there, it just looked absolutely terrifying. But actually, that kind of instability is here all the time. It's here all the time. We pretend it's not because we construct these habits that keep reassuring us that everything's stable. And every once in a while, it becomes impossible for us to maintain that fiction of stability. And then it's very often the case that we respond in unproductive ways. So, one way to respond is with sort of like a sense of loss, right? A sense of loss, it's like, I have a friend of mine that I've known most of my life. We went to elementary school and high school together, and then he went off to a different university. And I was talking to him about 15 years ago, and he said, you know, Kurt, the best years of my life were in high school. I mean, he's a nice guy, but I felt so sorry for him, right? I mean, so every time life has presented him with things dissolving, you know, he goes back in his mind and says, oh, if only it was like high school, right? Oh, that was such a great time. Everybody knew who I was. I was voted most popular. I'm talking about him, not me. I was not voted most popular in my high school. So, you know, basically, I think he, Dennis is his name. You know, I think he just responds to the instability of things with this very powerful sense of nostalgia. And you know, we also can respond to it in other ways, too. We can respond to it with anger. You know, anger is very common, and we see it in the United States right now to, like, an extraordinary degree. And it's caused by things are dissolving. It's long before the COVID-19, lots of things are dissolving around us. And many of our fellow Americans are responding with rage, right? And that's a kind of nostalgia too. You know, don't let things change. We can make America great again, right? So you know, that is an appeal to nostalgia and a sense of loss. And it's saying, you know, let's go back, but there's no going back. You know, so Zen is like training. It's like Zen is like, we're going to push you out of the airplane at whatever, 20,000 feet, or I have no idea. And here's the parachute, you know, and your Zen training is your parachute. And we're going to push you out of the plane and out you go, and you're going to learn how to, you're going to learn you don't need your parachute, actually. That you are like being in the formless, being in the dissolve, the impermanent is like your true home. You are like we're like a whale kept at SeaWorld. And we're living in this little cement enclosure, and we're told this is the world of water. But actually, you know, we belong in the deep ocean of Wuxin. You know, we will come alive in that in the formless realm. That's where our true nature lies. And, you know, koan training is like pushing people in that direction. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. So, you know, we want to explain that in terms of things we already know, right? And the teacher is going to say, no, that's not the answer. That's not the answer. And eventually what happens is that you kind of start drifting. You say, I don't know what the answer is. And you're sitting there in emptiness and you're saying, give, take, give, take. And after a while, you know, you become comfortable with not knowing. And you become comfortable with allowing things to unfold in their own way. See, allowing things to unfold in their own way. And as I said yesterday, you know, people become observant of this process. When you're frightened or you're angry or you're nostalgic or you're ironic or you're, you know, whatever, you can't respond in a lively way to what's happening around you. It makes you. Actually, there was a teacher named Krishnamurti, Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he actually has one. I'm not a fan of Krishnamurti, but he says one thing that's really interesting. He said, fear makes people unintelligent. And he's so right. Fear makes people unintelligent. And so when we're afraid, we become unintelligent, or when we're stuck, or when we're feeling helpless, or so basically, koan training does that to all of us, right? And yet, you know, you realize that in this openness, which is so unwelcome in so many ways, there's this tremendous chance to come alive, right? You know, if people practice Zen for 3 days, you know, if you stay at Sesshin for 3 days and you sit in emptiness for 3 days, it's like it's like every atom in your body has been rejuvenated. And that feeling of energy and aliveness is impossible without stepping outside of our energy habits. And, you know, Zen is all about learning how to trust that experience of not knowing, of being outside the familiar, as happened last night. And koan training too is a little bit artificial, right? It's a very controlled situation, but sometimes things really do go to pieces all around us. And you know, if you know how to respond or welcome that dissolution, life takes on a very different character. So finally, I'm getting to the koan, finally. You know, Joshu Jiaozhou was a great Chan master, Zen master of the Tang Dynasty. And as far as I'm concerned, he's probably the greatest of all the Zen masters of that really luminous period. And, you know, when he was 19 years old, he went to a sesshin. A little bit like Masai. I think she was like 17 and went to a sesshin. And when Joshu, Jiaozhou, went to sesshin, he had, unusually, this is, most of us don't have this experience, but he had a Daikensho experience, one, and you can have many. And he lived his whole life going through this process of entering emptiness and embracing the formless as it unfolds in time. And this is a Joshu in a period of his life after his teacher, Nansen, had died, and everybody expected Joshu to take over the temple. But instead, Joshu went out on the road and visited all these other Zen masters in China. And when he would go to different temples, sometimes monks would challenge his insight. It's like, so you're the great Joshu, eh? Well, let me ask you a question. And sometimes the questions were genuinely motivated by a desire to know. So a monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? What does it mean to be you? What does it mean to be you? You, and you, and you, and you. And Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. So, you know, that's the life of Zen cultivation, right? He didn't say, I'm Joshu, right? I'm the great Joshu. I'm the premier student of the great Nanchuan. You know, everybody knows me from one end of China to the other. He didn't say, I'm a great Zen master. You know, he said, I'm an open gate. I'm an open gate. You know, I'm an open gate. My true self is in the impermanent, right? I am embracing that formless energy, right? All the time as it unfolds, see? And that's very difficult to do. That's a very accomplished person. And we can do it too if we cultivate the mind of emptiness, right? That's what Zen practice is all about, cultivating the mind of emptiness. And it's a deeply transformative process. As I mentioned yesterday, every time you feel yourself hardening up, you feel yourself tightening up, it's like your muscles are getting tighter, or your mind is getting more brittle. You feel yourself clenching in response to things. That's samsara. That clenching is samsara. And so, you know, you can detect yourself clenching. You can detect yourself hardening in response to change. And in response to things on the cushion, uncertainty, even pain. You know, nobody welcomes pain. But, you know, the worst thing you can do when you have pain in your legs, besides continuously moving, is to try to fight it. You know, that actually makes things worse. You're becoming hardened. You know, the way to respond to pain in your legs is to empty out, become a gate. Let everything pass through you. Let everything pass through you in life. Let everything pass through you. That's the art of Zen, right? So, you know, tired, let it all pass through you. Be an empty gate. You know, that's what we're really doing with Mushin practice. We're learning how to be an empty gate. Whatever happens is a welcome event. Whatever happens is the visitor that can bring our awakening. You know, there's a teaching in Buddhism that there's a Buddha to come. Buddha to come, and his name is Maitreya. So the previous Buddha, according to Buddhist cosmology, was named Dipankara Buddha. And when Shakyamuni Buddha was just a young man, I should say, this is like a million years ago, he met Dipankara Buddha, and he was so awestruck by Dipankara Buddha, according to Buddhist teaching, that he resolved to become a Buddha. Now, you know, most of Dipankara Buddha's followers, when they met him, resolved to become enlightened and become bodhisattvas, or arhats even. Those are people who have completely awakened and are now free from birth and death. But to vow to become a Buddha is actually to follow a different path. The path of the Buddha is not to awaken in one life and then be free from birth and death. The path of the Buddha is to go through countless lifetimes of service to others. It's a big job, right? Most people aren't up to the task. So this young man said to Dipankara, "I am so moved by your example that I vow to become a Buddha, not a bodhisattva, not an enlightened arhat, but a Buddha." And so he went through all of these lifetimes of challenging events that in which he helped other beings and was reborn as our Buddha, Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama. And then the Buddha to come is called Maitreya. Maitreya actually means like loving kindness or friend. Maitreya means friend. So Maitreya is the next Buddha, see? But my theory is that the next Buddha is always coming. He's never going to arrive, because he's the Buddha that's always emerging. He's emerging out of the formless, right? There's a kind of order that's arising every moment out of the dissolution of everything around us. You know, many people would say that this is a terrible time to be alive. But actually, you know, a new world is already on the way. It's already taking shape around us. As things are dissolving into formlessness, you know, it's like a sand painting, like those Tibetan mandalas, right? Those mandalas, you know. Basically, they make them and then they dissolve them, but that's not the end. Another mandala is forming right now, even as we speak. And so, you know, that's true in your life too. You know, if you wake up, you're part of the emerging order that will benefit all beings. So, you know, you're not just here for yourself, even if that is your motive right now. You know, this is, your learning how to deal with the dissolution of things around you is so essential, because that's the kind of person who can create this new order. Joshu was such a person, and everybody here can be that person. So please continue to practice with wholehearted diligence. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. With the Bakuya sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappears, and an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappears, and a handsome one comes. Emerging order and dissolving. Emerging and dissolving. Emerging and dissolving. Life is found in death, and death is in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? Main subject, a monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Setua's verse, its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was as clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, east, south, and west, in every direction, openness. But the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. We can't make things happen. We become one with what's happening. That's transcendental wisdom. So please, everybody this morning was sitting very deeply. It's very moving to see that practice. Please keep practicing.